This is the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I am your host, Richard James Rogers, high school science and chemistry teacher and author of the award-winning book, The Quick Guide to Classroom Management. Welcome to today's episode on the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I am your host, as always, Richard James Rogers. And today I have a special treat for you because we're going to be discussing ways to increase metacognition. And I have a special guest with us today. Corinna, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Hello, everybody. I'm Corinna. I am head of science at Garden International School here in Rayong. And I'm a physics teacher and I love physics. I just want to give everybody the feeling physics is achievable, specifically for girls. And it's a way there is still so many discoveries to be made. And I want everybody to study physics and think it's achievable and doable.
Wow, fantastic. Lots of admirable goals there, Corinna, making physics achievable and goals that are believable. Certainly when I was in school, I enjoyed physics, but I found it quite challenging as a subject because of its mathematical content and the key terminology that were involved in the subject. And it's a really interesting segue into my next question, because that is, how do you make physics, digestible and make those goals achievable for your students, learning such a challenging subject like that?
Well, it takes a while for you as a teacher to feel confident to teach the subject. You know, you have to build up your content knowledge. If you don't know where the students might struggle or what is the best way of teaching your content, then it is hard for the students to follow you. And that's what a new teacher struggles with, gets the content knowledge. When you have the content knowledge, and I'm honest, it took me more than 5 years to feel comfortable teaching without notes, I still have my PowerPoint because my handwriting is horrendous, but I teach without having the PowerPoint on. The students can go back and look at it and write notes then. But when you have your content knowledge, then you start with the pedagogical knowledge. You start to experiment what areas of learning and teaching are you interested in. And when you have decided what you want to do, then you have to combine those tools. And that's what makes you then become an expert teacher. And I'm not an expert teacher, but I'm working towards to become one and help my students to achieve those goals. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing is to decide what you want to do. And I experimented a lot with feedback and also with blended learning. And blended learning is something that I discovered is specifically good for those lower ability students who think physics is not achievable.
Oh, wow, fantastic. So lots of things you've mentioned there, Corinna, certainly about the blending the things that you're interested in terms of the pedagogical knowledge and having that foundation of subject knowledge before a kind of progressing into developing the pedagogical techniques. You've mentioned blended learning there, Corinna. For those listening to this who might not be too sure about what blended learning is, because it's only recently I've learned actually what blended learning actually is. Could you please explain to everybody what blended learning is and how you do that at your school?
So I learned about blended learning first last year from Dr. Kathleen Tucker. Blended learning is an umbrella expression that combines different stations. She is great in those station rotation models or in having a playlist. That's where you give the students different tasks. A lot of people think blended learning is online, offline. That's only part of it. There is an online part to it. And I started using that when we were all online during COVID. And I thought, how can I make a station rotation model while being online and teaching physics. And I decided to use Class Sites, which is part of the Google Suite. And I created On Class Sites as a web-based site, very easy to manage. I created those stations. There's a teacher-led stations where the students can come and ask questions or clarification, or I can use it to give some feedback. Then we have an online station, and the online station is always a short video about what I taught the students. Not just me, sometimes I videotape myself, sometimes I use videos that are on YouTube, short, not longer than 5 minutes, so the students can go back and listen as they need it. Then the third one is an offline task, and I choose different tasks, either practice word problems or answering some questions or looking at the syllabus. And I always ask my students questions about the syllabus, and they can ask their own question and answer these. But the one that is really interesting to me is the fourth station, which is collaboration. And I try to put in a task there that combines teaching physics to a real world problem. Mm-hmm. And that's where the deep learning comes in, because I then thought, what task do I give my students that interests them? The girls don't want to know how to build an engine. I have to find something else that speaks to them. Mm-hmm. And the blended learning combined with the deep learning gives me the opportunity to do that. And then the fifth station is independent learning, where the students do keywords. And the keywords, I'm not using just writing down the keywords, I'm using the Freya model. Do you know what that is?
Oh, no, I've not heard of the Freya model. Could you tell me more?
The Freya model uses four sections, and in the middle is your keyword. For example, green energy. And then you, in one box, you write definition. In the other word, you can choose a characteristic or a picture. Then you find an example and a non-example.
Okay.
And the students keep asking me, why do I have to find a non-example? And I keep telling them that teaches you the boundary. You know, sometimes they don't know, where do I apply this definition and where does it stop? Mm. By looking at the non-example, these boundaries, the contrast and compare, what are the similarities and differences? This becomes clear to them.
Mm, I see. Wow, wow. So it sounds like with these stations that you're using, Corinna, it's first of all multi-sensory and multidisciplinary, because the students are using different methods at each station. And it seems as though there's a lot of review and a lot of reflection, and a lot of going back and a lot of retrieval that's happening. Would you say that's the case?
I start all my lessons with retrieval practice, mm. because those are short main point questions without any stake. Mm. So it takes away the anxiety, and I'm not asking application questions there. I just ask simple basic concepts, no calculations, just the definitions. How it is applied, for example, what's thermal energy, what's heat energy. Mm. Those are the big concepts. And if they don't know the big concepts, it's difficult to go on. And if you then space that retrieval practice out and you interleave it, you make a daily revision of the whole course, and you don't need to waste 2 hours or 2 weeks, sorry, before the mock exams for the students to revise. You do that in each lesson. Mm. And that cuts down on time as well that you need to spend on revision.
Fantastic. So we're spacing out the retrieval practice, and it's not so high stakes. It's kind of removing the apprehension of the questions the students have to do. And I liked what you just said there, Corinna, about how the students have to be comfortable with the main themes before they can expand and do the calculations, mm-hmm. or the applications. Can you think of any specific example, maybe in physics or in another subject, perhaps, that you've taught over the years, where there's a key theme that has to be embedded first before the students expand on that?
Well, if you talk about mathematics, and students really struggle. Let me start in the beginning. The blended learning works really well with my lowest ability students. I tried to introduce that in year 10 to all three sets that we have. One is triple science, single science, the other two are coordinated. The single science didn't want it. Mm. They said, go teach us normal.
Okay.
But the other two groups that were teachers didn't have those high expectations, specifically the lowest group, they took to this really, really well. Mm. Because they can make connections to with the subject to their life, and I give them not a choice. You know, I started with Jamboard, choice board.
Okay, yeah.
But you give them the choice. Here, I give them an option. I give them an option of a task. They have different ideas, but they can always come and say, oh, can I show you this skill by using a different research topic, by presenting it in a different way? And that gets engagement, and that gets the students excited about doing physics and seeing it is achievable and it's fun. And I can talk about something that is applicable to my hobbies and interests.
Mm.
And that was really successful because, you know, if I look how these low ability students do in my physics class, they are 2 grades better than in the same students in the other two sciences.
Wow.
Where
wow.
they are taught in the normal way. And that's really good.
That's a massive achievement, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's something that I've certainly noticed over the years I've been teaching as well, Karina, the idea of using the students' personal interests, giving them options, and then somehow allowing the subject content to combine with the students' interest or getting the students to somehow combine them themselves. And with these students you're talking about, I presume they have to produce some kind of creative output at the mm-hmm. end of that process, is that right?
Yeah. Let's just talk about the energy you said. Give us a concrete example. Students in the lower group struggle with solving equations. So for example, explaining them speed is equal to distance over time, and then solve for distance and you apply the mathematics, it just doesn't work.
Mm.
So I just go and tell them, okay, if you have to find the denominator, you switch the variable on the left side with the denominator. If you want to find the numerator, you just multiply the other two together.
Mm.
Yes, you could use a triangle, but they cannot remember what to put in the triangle.
Mm.
It's difficult enough to memorize the formula. So that's one of the applications I do with them, and I drill them in doing this, you know. Drilling has become a bad taste in the last few years because they said you should not drill students, it should be exciting, engaging. But for being able to make the connection and linking the subject knowledge, you have to have a good foundation and you have to drill this foundation. And if they are confident with that foundation and they know where to find their knowledge, then it's so easy to transform it or to transfer it to other areas that they haven't encountered before. Critical thinking is something you cannot teach. Critical thinking is something that develops if you have the foundation and you feel comfortable to go, you know, I compare to drawers, to filing drawers. And if you know in which drawer you have to go to open it and see what knowledge is in there, then you can make those connections. And to help students doing this, I have started on all my Google sites for each lesson, I created a filing cabinet. And they have that overview how the topics belong together, because we as teacher, we know in this unit, for example, unit 2 is motion. I know, okay, there is motion, then there is forces, and there are effects of forces and energy. The students don't know this. So I show them, and I show them in this filing cabinet, this is called motion, this there are the subheadings. And I hope that helps them to avoid cognitive overload, freeze the working memory, and take that information into their long-term memory. Have you ever asked yourself why some students always get it and some don't?
I have, yes, I have asked that question. It's a mystery sometimes, isn't it?
I have read some research about this, and people said those students who always get it, you know, I start my lessons with brain dumps.
Okay.
Don't you?
What do you mean by how do you say that?
Brain dumps. Brain I asked dumps, them, what do you know about motion? What do you remember from key stage three? And then they all write it down, and then I give them time to make pair share, and then they report back to me, and I write it all on the board.
Okay.
And I say, that's what you all do. But those students who get it, they are able in their mind to take that brain dump, which is just a list, and make a mind map out of it.
Okay.
And then I ask them, make a mind map, or we do the mind map together, and I try to implement those filing cabinets. They are backed by the filing cabinets. However they want to do it, but it, I think it helps them to go back in their long-term memory and open the right doors. And how do we make this connection? By practice.
Practice and practice, yeah.
That builds the new synapses in your brain, makes a connection from the working memory to the long-term memory, and that's how they become better. And you know, I share that with them. It's not a mystery. I start usually the new year by teaching them how to learn, how to memorize, how to become better in knowing what I don't know. It's not just getting information into the student's head, but getting the information out.
Fantastic. Wow, lots of juice to extract from all of that there, Corinna. Well, during that very interesting series of descriptions you just gave, you mentioned critical thinking and metacognition. And I was just wondering if you could please perhaps explain to everybody what critical thinking is, first of all, because I think a lot of teachers think they know what critical thinking is, but actually don't know what it is. I'm one of them, by the way. And also metacognition, what is metacognition? And also, how do you, Corinna, and I know this is a lot to ask you, how do you increase your students' metacognition? You've mentioned some techniques so far. Could you tell us a bit more? So what is critical thinking? What is metacognition? How do you combine those two, and how do you increase those skills in your students?
Well, the easiest way to say what is metacognition, because students ask me that as well, is thinking about thinking.
Thinking about thinking.
Reflecting about what you have learned, reflecting about how you learn, reflecting about your mistakes, setting targets to improve on your mistakes. Think critical about what you really know. Mistakes in my class is something that you celebrate. I call it, what wonderful mistakes have we made today?
Oh, I like that.
Because if you don't make mistakes, you don't know where you have to improve. And that goes then back to the study technique, you know. How many students read the book, feel confident, go into the test, and are very disappointed because they couldn't apply the knowledge? Because reading gives you a false sense of security, of knowing. But really knowing comes only with retrieval. So a way of just reading and highlighting, I do that, but I go back and then I use the information I have highlighted to in any way use dual coding to represent it in a different way, because that makes a connection. So if I highlight something, I ask my students, go back and make a mind map. Make people don't like mind maps, okay, make a graphic organizer, make a flow chart, anything else than written text, and do it from memorization. Critical thinking is difficult, I said that already, to teach. And it can only come when your knowledge is fluent. If you have fluent knowledge, then you can think about how can I look at it from a different point of view. Is there a different way of solving a problem? Is there a different opinion to that specific topic? I mean, in science, we are critical thinking all the time. How do we know? What is the evidence? What data have we collected? What conclusion can we draw from there? But we can only draw those conclusions if we have the basic knowledge. So what do I do? I have read a lot about from John Hattie about feedback, and that has spiked my interest in creating something he recommended by making a list making a list of common mistakes in your subject. He had one in his book for mathematics, so I thought, well, I can take some of these ideas and make it for science. So I started creating this it's a table, and it has three columns. One column has the mistake. Then the middle column is what can I learn from this mistake, and the next, the right one is the next step. How can I avoid this mistake? And for physics, I came up with six categories: reading mistakes, acquisition of knowledge, you just don't know it; strategic mistakes, I don't know how to apply it; I don't know what to use; or mistakes in the execution of the knowledge. That means I use the wrong formula, I make a wrong step; calculation, because a lot of students don't know how to use the calculator. And then the findings: how many students lose marks because the power of tens are wrong or there are no units. So these are all the mistakes. And the other sciences, then we met together and we agreed these are the mistakes for science. And then we used the middle column to come up with what to learn. For example, reading, slow down, underline the keywords, what is answered. I was doing a lot of marking for IGCSE over the summer for the Cambridge board. And there were a lot of explain questions, and you had not tick marks, you had to mark in a band. And I realized if I could still ask why, what, or how the student has not explained. Well, I shared this knowledge with my students, you know, those long answers where they have to explain something. I tell them, if you can still ask why, you haven't got the marks. So that's something my students then use. Everybody has a copy, I introduce it to them, and they go through when they get their tests back. I have created an Excel sheet for every question that is in the the test and across those six areas, and then they tick, what did I do wrong? Was it a knowledge, an execution, or was it a misunderstanding? And then they count in the end, and where they have the most marks is surprising, where they have the most ticks. So this one student said, oh, I have all my mistakes were reading mistakes. And from there, they write their targets. They write three targets. They write how they achieve it and by when, what areas they have to concentrate on to become better, and what challenges they face in making that come true. So the feedback is taken away from me doing all the work to them actually identifying where they went wrong.
Fantastic. And I think that's more powerful, isn't it, when the students have realized where they've gone wrong, they've discovered it themselves, and then they're formulating targets and taking action. And how often do you get your students to set targets, Karina? How often do you think that process should happen?
Well, last year I started doing this, and I did it after each test. But then I did one mistake. I didn't go back and revisited what they have done. And the students set all the targets, and I hope they have applied them. But they should have gone back and look at them halfway through the next unit, at the end of the next unit. And that's something I do now, following up, right? We have so many good plans, but we have to have a long-term plan to follow through with what we do. So this year, they go back after 2 weeks and look at their targets. They look, have I done this? Have I read more carefully? What does my homework show? Have I improved? Have I used this technique? And I want them to do it again before the test. And then after the test, it will be interesting to compare those two. Have they improved? Have they taken those advice they give themselves to heart, and did it work? And I am quite excited about seeing if there is actually an improvement. Also in science, you know, there are different topics that the students prefer over others. So it might not be a fair comparison, but I'm excited about seeing what will happen with this.
I can tell that, and I think the students must get excited as well, because they're not just learning about physics or learning about the subject, they're learning about themselves, aren't they? They're learning about their own strengths and weaknesses. And I think children do get excited when they find out more about themselves, don't they?
Yeah, and that's then where the metacognition comes in. You know, they take charge of their own learning and they become independent learners. It's not the teacher tells me the target, the teacher tells me what to do. And in one of the books or the reports I'm reading, they don't call it feedback, they call it feed forward.
Oh, wow.
Because it should help you to become better, right?
Okay, yes, I
and
like that.
It's, what was the other one? Catch-up sessions.
Mm.
I'm not calling them catch-up sessions. They are getting ahead sessions.
Oh, I love this. I love this mentality.
So there is this positive spin, the growth mindset, right?
Mm.
You can change. You can do anything you set your mind to. And these students, you should see, a student who never gets a B in science, and all of a sudden they get a B in physics. And they cannot believe it. And they are so pleased with themselves. Another way of providing feedback and getting the communication between parents and students is, after each test, students have to write an email to their parents.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they have to CC me in to see they have done it. And they either have to tell them, I did really well because I did this and this, or I did not so good this time because I didn't do this, but next time I will improve by, and they use their own targets.
Wow, I love that idea.
And there were some really good communications between parent and students. One student was in tears because her father wrote her such a nice email and saying, I'm so proud of you, and I'm so proud that you analyzed what you did wrong, and I know you can do better. And it was really positive.
Corinna, I think this is brilliant. I think you're really describing a lot of groundbreaking things here, things that I think a lot of teachers just haven't even considered. For me personally, I've recognized for some time now the great need for schools to utilize the parent domain and the parent dynamic, the parent-child dynamic. And I do think that parents are very much underutilized in schools. And I think you've just described a great method by which the parents can get involved and look at the empowering effect that can have. Have you ever seen a negative consequence of doing the emails to parents, or do you foresee anything bad coming of that?
I don't know. I cannot take credit for this idea. It's, again, it's a blended learning activity that Dr. Kathleen Tucker pointed out. But some parents don't want to get involved.
Mm.
But I cannot see how a parent can be upset about a positive result, because they usually get the negatives. Your son hasn't done the homework. Your son hasn't done this or that. So getting an email that is positive, I think it should be positive. And if there is something negative, we deal with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We spin it around and we convince the parents that communication with their children is always good.
Fantastic. I love this stuff, Corinna. It sounds like there's a lot of students who they don't realize how their parents feel about their progress. And I think especially with older students, with teenagers, it can be a challenge getting them to communicate with their parents. So there often are barriers between parents and children. Another thing I was really interested in, Corinna, is you mentioned about a lot of strategies for feedback today, and you've talked about students setting targets. And I'm just wondering how do you mark notebooks and homework and things like that? You know, the day-to-day kind of written work. How do you deal with that?
Well, we are at the process of rewriting a policy how to do that. But if you go to the Endowment Education Foundation, I don't know if you know that website.
Yes, I do.
They are really, really good. And there is a lot of research being done in giving feedback. And they say, they recommend that is left to the teacher. It's left to the teacher when and how to give feedback, whether it is verbal or whether it is individual or whole class or whether it's in the book. The teacher knows best, and we should give teachers the courtesy of their knowledge, that they know when and how to deliver the feedback. For example, my homework, I never had a problem with feedback because homework questions are always past paper questions,
because
they need to learn how to answer them. And what I have learned in this session, that I just talked about, the Endowment Foundation, is don't mark your multiple choice questions circle the right answer, just mark it wrong. And then gives the students an opportunity to do it again. Or if there is a wrong answer, give them a cue and give them a chance to improve on that work. Again, that's something from the blended learning, by having these activities, it frees your time to give individual feedback to students, whether that's written or verbally, but you can help them to actually understand what went wrong there. Or if it is a misconception or a mistake that everybody does, I explain it to the whole class. I have never heard about book looks before. Okay. I taught in an English school in the UK. And it has taken so much out of the teaching profession, the hours that teachers had to spend at home marking, that Ofsted now has turned around and recommends not to do that anymore. So I hopefully think that we as professional know how much and how much feedback we give. The best way we can do is giving them any kind of feedback. John Hattie says that is the most influential way of improving the outcome for the student. Feedback and efficacy. And efficacy is the energy the students have, right? And it's not just the energy of the students, it's our energy. If our energy is low, students' energy is low. And there is a really interesting correlation between our level of energy and the students' results. If our cup is empty, we cannot pour. So it's the well-being of teachers and students is a really important aspect, I think, of the teaching profession. And there are some good providers out there that help schools to develop outstanding practices to look after your teacher and your students. But let me tell one thing, because yes. I have to mention something out of your book.
Okay.
And I first found that in 2015. It is your window poster.
Yes.
And
poster
that's
game,
such
yeah.
a wonderful activity, specifically with the lowest ability. I use that either for them to define a word, and then I say, make it as difficult as possible, because you have to go outside and another group has to copy it back. And the one who does it best is the winner. But I also use it if I see in the homework something went wrong. For example, students couldn't draw wavefronts when we talked about wave reflection and refraction. So I drew different scenarios and I put it out. And then in groups of two, they had to recreate this, which was a really fun activity. Thank you
fantastic.
For providing us with those ideas.
Well, it's I've certainly found that they've worked over the years. And like you've said, Corinna, with these low ability students, I've often found over the years that there is this kind of mentality from a lot of teachers, and I'm not necessarily blaming them, but there is this kind of mentality that if a student or a group of students have not achieved very well for several years and they're well below average, there's this kind of mindset that we should give up on them and just go through the motions, get them to the exams, and then they're probably going to leave school anyway, so we can forget about them. And you know, I really think that's the wrong mindset, because as you've identified with the poster game and with the blended learning activities you mentioned and the class sites and all this stuff, there are ways to reach these students, aren't there?
Absolutely. You see, when we talk to them in a way, in a subject or in an area that interests them, they bloom. And when they see you, they say to me, you're the first person who tells me I can do it.
Wow.
And that's good. But I have to tell you, I have 5 children. I have dealt with teenagers, and I specifically like that age, the teenagers, when they become difficult and they test their boundaries. So I have my experience as a mom in the classroom. But I also read a book, When Adults Change, Everything Changes. And that's how I got interested in pedagogy. And it talked about the difficult students, the ones that we think that are lost causes. And I don't give detention anymore, because it's always the same student, isn't it? I give meditation.
Oh,
So
wow.
when they come to my classroom, there is no detention. They come and sit, they close their mind, I play some soft music, and they have to sit there for 15 minutes if they want to sleep, fine. And then they go home and do their work again. And I had students who said, Miss, can I have detention today for meditation?
Wow, wow, what a change of
things. We have to
yeah.
break that, that cycle, you know. Those students, they have so many detentions, they cannot sit them up. This is not the right way forward. We fail them if we don't try to find ways of engaging them. And I have to say, I'm teaching 18 years now. There was only one student that I could not reach, and I tried everything. But otherwise, I always got the students to work for me and to like the subject.
Wow, it sounds so important, that, isn't it, to work for you and to like the subject. And really interesting stuff that you've described today, Corinna. I've got a final two questions for you, which I hope will help a lot of people listening today. Everything you've said has been really interesting. If you could just mention one thing that everyone should take from today's conversation, what would that one thing be?
Have high expectations. Everybody can achieve. The sky is not your limit. The stars are not your limit. You set the limit.
Wow. I love that. And what would you say to a newly qualified teacher who's just about to start their first teaching job and everything's new to them? What kind of practical advice would you give them that they can use right away in the classroom?
Start with retrieval practice. We have a newly qualified teacher who started this year, and he come up with a fantastic idea for retrieval. He has one slide, four boxes again, a question in the four questions, and then around there he has how it links to the topic and how it links to the keywords. And I think that is just a fantastic idea. Retrieval changed my way of teaching. That was the first step into pedagogy. And also, don't be afraid to admit that you don't know. I don't know how many times I had to go and say, I don't know, I have to read up. If the students see you are honest about it, then they will respect this and connect to them on a personal level. Share a little bit about yourself. Show them you are human and make mistakes and admit to it. And be prepared that you will need time to get an expert in your content knowledge. Even if you have a university degree with 90-89%, you still are so many things you have to learn and become fluent in. It's not just a student. Be a lifelong learner and model this, and then student will follow your example.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I think that's a very inspirational message, Corinna, to anyone listening to this, and lots of great information that we've discussed today. Well, thank you, Corinna, for sharing your knowledge and expertise with us today. I think what you've said has been really interesting. It's been very, very useful. I've learned a lot from talking with you today. Where can people go if they want to find out more about this stuff, the blended learning, the retrieval practice, the metacognition, the target setting? There's so many topics that we've discussed today. Where would you recommend people go?
Well, a free site to start with is an Education Endowment Foundation. It's a fantastic website. It has a lot of guidance how to teach different subjects. There's a fantastic one for science, for English literacy. But I also do like the book Powerful Teaching. That is specific about retrieval practice, and I have so many ideas how to do that in different ways. That was very good. I mean, your book is fantastic. It has so many good ideas. John Hattie is another read about feedback that helped me to develop those strategies I have. And then I just would start looking around what you like and look at the names that are evidence-based and not something that just one person has written down. You have to have evidence-based practices that work, and that should be a guidance of what you want to read and research.
Wonderful. I think that's a great concluding sentence, that, Corinna, you have to have evidence-based practice in the classroom. I think that's so important. Well, thank you so much again, Corinna. And for everyone listening, you can find this podcast episode everywhere, basically. But if you go to richardjamesrogers.com/podcast, you'll find all the links to all of my episodes at the Practical Teaching Tips podcast. Thanks again, Corinna, and everybody else. Until next time, bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.